call the last case of today, 97-0885-CR State v. Hansford. Counsel, Assistant State representing Mr. Hansford.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Suzanne Hagopian, and I represent the defendant appellant Ronald Hansford. For more than 150 years, the people of this state have been guaranteed the right to a 12-person jury. When Wisconsin was still a territory, the common law provided for juries of 12. When this state adopted its constitution in 1848, the common law right became a constitutional right. Indeed, this court upheld in a long line of cases that the Constitution guarantees the right to a jury of 12 in civil cases, in criminal cases. There is no exception for misdemeanor cases. This body of case law proves beyond a reasonable doubt that 1995 Wisconsin Act 427 is unconstitutional. In that act, the legislature attempted to reduce the size of the jury in misdemeanor cases from 12 to 6 persons. Ronald Hansford was one of the first affected by the new law. The state had charged him with 3 misdemeanors, and he was facing incarceration totaling 27 months. Nevertheless, his request for a 12-person jury was denied, and he was tried before a jury of 6. Mr. Hansford was denied his right to a constitutional jury trial. This court should reverse his convictions and declare Act 427 unconstitutional. I've referred to a long line of cases. What I'm referring to specifically is the body of case law in which this court has held that the Constitution guarantees the right to a 12-person jury. When one looks at this body of case law, 2 things are particularly striking. One is how early in our statehood some of these decisions came down. And by early, I mean within 5 years when the Constitution was adopted. And the second thing is the utter consistency of these decisions. The court has included this language in civil cases, criminal cases, misdemeanor case. This court and the Court of Appeals have said that the Constitution guarantees the right to a jury of 12 in criminal cases, in cases spanning 140 years. And I would submit that if this court is going to find Act 427 constitutional, it must overrule that case law. The first case, the one decided 5 years after the Constitution was adopted, is Norville versus Rice. In that court, the court was presented with a statute like that today, which would have provided for only 6-person juries. The court held that statute unconstitutional. In doing so, it looked at the common law in existence when the Constitution was adopted, the practices in existence, and indeed the common law that had existed in England and dated back some 600 years. And the court concluded that the framers of the state constitution, when they guaranteed the right to a jury trial, they meant a jury of 12 persons.
Ms. Hagopian, do you think Norville versus Rice is still good law today?
Yes, definitely.
Let me ask you about something that I find interesting, at least. Norville versus Rice obviously was a case involving a civil issue. It was a civil jury trial issue. We have now in our present law a provision that allows for, and in fact seems to presume, a 6-person jury in a civil case unless someone pays an additional fee to get 12 jurors, or unless the judge decides on his own or her own motion that there should be 12 jurors. How do you reconcile that with Norville versus Rice?
I assume you're referring to the statutory provisions that are in place
I am indeed. In fact, the statutory provision I'm referring to is 756.096 paren 3 paren B.
And that provision does allow a party in a civil case to have a jury of 12. Now, the fact that there may be fees associated with any jury trial, I believe, is allowable, and really, though not specifically addressed in Norville, there certainly, even at that time the Constitution was adopted, there were fees in place that, for example, in the criminal context, if someone was prosecuted before a justice of the peace, they might have a 6-person jury, but would have the right to a 12-person in the court of record on appeal in the district court, and they might have to post some sort of surety to promise their appearance in the appeal. And that, as long as these would not be oppressive fees, would not deny an indigent person their right to a jury trial.
So it's your position that the legislature could not even in the civil arena say you're only entitled to a 6-person jury, constitutionally?
Yes.
So even a civil statute, a statute that applied to civil jury trials would be unconstitutional?
Yes.
Well, let me follow up on that, if I might, because the next section in the statute that we just referred to, after talking about the 6-person jury in a civil case, then talks about a forfeiture action. Now, a forfeiture action certainly is not criminal, so I assume that it's probably civil. And what it says is that the jury shall be 6 persons in a forfeiture action. How do we reconcile that with the Norville versus Rice case?
There are some matters that were not tried before juries at all at the time the Constitution was adopted. They were dealt with in the Court of Chancery. Those kinds of matters, since they didn't have the right to a jury trial when the Constitution was adopted, it is still permissible to not provide a jury or a jury of 12 today. And Section 5 specifically refers to the right of the jury trial remaining inviolate. So if it didn't exist at the time the Constitution was adopted, it would be permissible not to provide that today. Now, in the criminal context, there isn't any precedent for denying the defendant who is charged with a misdemeanor his or her right to a 12-person jury. There is no precedent for that. The state has, going back, looking through territorial statutes, has found instances where charges are pursued in the Justice of the Peace courts that they would have a 6-person jury. But the critical factor, which the court noted in Norville, was that that defendant would then have the right to appeal into what at that time was the district court, the court of record, where they would be entitled to a trial de novo before a 12-person jury. And Norville noted that. And that is how the court system was working at that time, so that in the criminal context, speaking specifically of misdemeanors and felonies, but excluding something that today would be considered a forfeiture, a civil matter, felonies and misdemeanors, people did have the right to a 12-person jury.
But there was, just so I understand, the justice of the peace concept did handle some types of criminal proceedings with a 6-person jury back at that time.
That is correct. That is correct.
So analogizing what you just said, how does that fit in then?
Well, because the critical distinction is that though the justice of the peace would entertain some criminal matters, the person who was convicted would not permanently be deprived of their 12-person jury as they are under Act 427.
Okay, he or she could always apply and go on up, is what you're saying.
Right.
If they paid the fee. I'm not sure, was there a fee due then?
The territorial statutes referred to some sort of modest surety that would have to be posted. You know, it's a little difficult in 1998, looking back at what was going on in 1848, and I think it's important to keep in mind that right before the Constitution was adopted, we had district courts, a court of record, a trial court. I believe there were three for the entire Wisconsin territory. Then there were the Justice of the Peace courts, which were primarily there to maintain order in this frontier that people were living in. So they had to deal with matters in a summary fashion. There had to be a layer of court down there that could deal with these things before the district court judge would come back into that part of the territory. And so the Justice of the Peace Courts, and it's interesting, the territorial statutes say that the justice is supposed to resolve the matter within a day. And so we're talking about a summary proceeding, but even then you had a right to a 6-person jury, and if you were convicted, you had a right to have a 12-person jury the next time that district judge came around. So even in a time when, frankly, it would have been rather inconvenient to provide for a 12-person jury in all of these matters, the state did. And I think it's significant that Norville recognized that. Norville didn't miss the point that there were justice courts handling civil criminal matters, but they were aware that those cases handled in the justice court would then have the right to appeal and have a 12-person jury.
Ms. Segovian, let me ask you another question that's given me some concern. When you look at Article 1, Section 7, it talks about specifically criminal proceedings. And then when you get into the constitutional provision itself, it talks about upon information or indictment. And after that, it then talks about the right to trial by jury. Now, certainly our experience today is that usually where there's an information or an indictment, we're talking about a felony situation, not a misdemeanor. How do you handle that somewhat incongruous situation?
Certainly. And even though today misdemeanors are by and large charged by complaint, we know from the case law that that was not necessarily the situation back when the Constitution was adopted. One of the early cases, 1877, State versus Lockwood, the defendant was charged with a misdemeanor by information. I can say with absolute certainty that that phrase, information or indictment, does not exclude misdemeanors from the jury trial right of Section 7. And the reason I can say that with absolute certainty is because this court has said that on numerous occasions. There are at least four decisions, the one I've mentioned, State versus Lockwood in 1877, there the court referred specifically to information or indictment as including both felonies and misdemeanors, and that is the phrase the court used.
So is the opposing counsel wrong when they say that no Wisconsin case has ever held or mandated a 6-person jury? In other words, you're saying that clearly every case has indicated that it must be a 12-person jury, that there's no exception.
Yes.
And that they say, the prosecution, that no Wisconsin case has held but legislatively mandated 6-person juries in misdemeanor could violate a person's right under the Constitution. They say, what they're saying is that there is no case that would make that and has made that decision.
Well,
and you're citing these four, that clearly that's not the case.
Well, as I understood what the state was saying was that the court has never before been presented with a statute that eliminated the right to a 12-person jury in a misdemeanor case. And since it hasn't before had the opportunity to rule on the constitutionality of that, this is the first time. However, you know, only 5 years after the Constitution was adopted, did address very related question.
I was expecting your answer to Justice Crooks to be that if you take the position that the right to jury trial is not that the words indictment and information, mm-hmm. if you take those words and you read that literally, then they never apply to the misdemeanor, therefore you're never entitled to a jury trial.
Well, that's absolutely true.
Well, that's not your position. Your position is you're entitled to a jury trial. What you're saying, I think, is that's the argument.
Yes.
And that's the argument you make in your brief.
Right. That is the logical conclusion if one reads information or indictment to exclude charges brought on complaint, that simply any person charged with a misdemeanor would not have a right to a jury trial, period. And that would be a radical departure from anything this court has held.
And on page 8 of the state's brief, footnote 5, and I did not check the history on this, it says that Article 1, Section 8, which is a subsequent provision, originally provided no person shall be held to answer for criminal offense unless on the presentment or indictment of a grand jury, except in cases cognizable. Which, not knowing the history, and maybe you do, made me think that when adopted with Section 7, they were referring to all criminal cases. Do you have any idea what I'm talking about?
Yes,
good.
I think I do anyway.
All right.
It seems that when we're talking about information or indictment, they were referring to matters prosecuted by the state. And at that time, the two ways that the state would bring charges against an individual would either be by grand jury indictment or by information. And this Article 1, Section 8, that amendment, which eliminated the reference to presentment or indictment of a grand jury and included a much broader phrase, came very early in our history. I believe it was in 1870. And there is case law that says once that amendment was adopted, the primary charging document in this state was an information. I think this court has wisely not hinged the right to a jury trial under Section 7 to
Let me interrupt you before you go on a little bit. One of the state's answers to that argument, as I understand it, is that they're not arguing that you're not entitled to a jury trial for a misdemeanor, but that jury can be defined differently for misdemeanors, and that Section 7 really defines it for purposes of felonies, the common law of a jury of 12. That's how I understand their argument. Would you address that argument?
I think the best response I can give is that the case law just does not support that interpretation. That this court has not drawn a distinction.
Well, their argument is existing case law established no precedent that would prohibit that interpretation.
But for example, look at State versus Slow, a decision from 1939. There, the defendant was charged by complaint with a misdemeanor, and he was denied a jury trial both in the Justice Court and in the Circuit Court. And in the Supreme Court, the state argued that he had no constitutional right to a jury trial because he was charged with a misdemeanor by a complaint. Essentially the same argument that's being made today in how this court should construe Section 7. And the court rejected that argument. It said that that claim, in fact, had been denied decades ago in the Lockwood decision, that Section 7 applies equally, that jury trial right, to felonies and misdemeanors.
And you don't think that you can draw a distinction in the kind of juries for misdemeanors and felonies under that reading, that the indictment or information gives rise to the jury of 12, and if you don't have the indictment or information, you have a jury trial right, but not necessarily a jury trial right to 12?
No, because there are really two conclusions existing simultaneously that this court has drawn. One is misdemeanors are covered by Section 7, and the second is the, quote, jury guaranteed by Section 7 means a body of 12. And this court has said that again and again and again. So that really, the unconstitutionality of Act 427 is really proven by stare decisis. Stand by things decided. That's precisely what we're asking this court to do. This court has said that it will only overrule existing precedent if there is strong justification. And I would submit that that justification needs to be especially strong when we're discussing, as we are today, not one decision, but a whole line of cases, and those cases are construing a constitutional provision and a fundamental right provided by the Constitution.
Well, but you have a very practical issue here. You have an issue that six-person juries are less expensive for the state than 12. You have conflicting data as to whether it really matters whether it's 6 or 12. I mean, there's really nothing magical about 12. It could have been 14 or 10. It can't be 5. And that's only magical because there's a U.S. Supreme Court case that says that. And what's the matter with viewing this Constitution as a living document? One that keeps abreast of the times, that recognizes jury, but at the same time does not place the law into irons by saying the jury has to be 12 and it has to do this and that and the other thing. What's the matter with that argument? This is just a very different kind of world we live in. Courts are much more crowded and busy. Imagine telling a judge today, get it all done in a day, as they did in the territorial days. I mean, what's the matter with that kind of argument?
Well, the state is not forever locked to a jury of 12. The change could be effected, but it would have to be done by constitutional amendment. This court has construed the meaning jury to mean 12 so that the requirement of 12 has essentially been written into the Constitution. And to change that, because the Constitution is ratified by the people, any change to a lesser number than 12 would also have to be done with the consent of the people.
Ms. Agopian, do you rely somewhat on Article 1, Section 5, as well as Article 1, Section 7?
I believe that the case law is somewhat ambiguous whether both sections apply or just Section 7. I believe that there are good reasons why Section 5 could be read to apply. We've got the more recent cases from this court and the Court of Appeals in the criminal context referring to both Sections 5 and 7. We have the 1922 amendment to Section 5, which allowed for the 5-6 verdict in civil cases, and that amendment specifically refers to civil cases, which would seem unnecessary if that applied only to civil. In addition, though the debates from the Constitutional Convention really say little about jury size, there is a rather lengthy and flowery oratory by a delegate, Charles Larkin, who had proposed an amendment to Section 5. And in his discussion of that amendment, he refers to both civil and criminal cases, a further indication that perhaps it indeed does apply to both.
Well, let me interrupt. The reason I ask the question is because one of the early Wisconsin cases, Bennett versus State, is a case where the court makes it very clear that, and I'm quoting, it is evident that Section 5 referred to and was intended to secure the right of trial by jury in civil and not in criminal actions. And that gives me some concern because, as I read your argument, you are using Article 1, Section 5. You're using the provision at the very beginning that says the right to trial by jury shall remain inviolate. And so don't you have to be able to use that to make your argument that under the common law in criminal cases there was the right to 12?
No. And my argument
is... Then why can't the legislature change the common law?
Because this court has written into the Constitution the right to a 12-person jury in Section 7 to the same degree as it did in Section 5. What the court was construing is the word jury, which it has described as a technical term having a specific meaning in the common law. And it has interpreted the Constitution's use of the word jury in both Section 5 and Section 7 identically. They both mean a jury of 12. But I believe that, for example, because of the Bennett decisions and those that follow that said, in the criminal context, we're relying on Section 5 and, Section 7, and Section 7 guarantees the right to a 12-person jury, that those cases stand independently, really, and guarantee the right to a jury of 12, have interpreted the Constitution to do precisely that. And any change of that would have to come through constitutional amendment.
So you're really comfortable relying on Article 1, Section 7 itself?
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Wooley, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state.
May it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Sharon Rooley, and I'm appearing on behalf of the plaintiff respondent, the state of Wisconsin. With regard to Act 427, the analysis begins with a presumption. It begins with a presumption that Act 427 is constitutional. The analysis also begins with the language of the Constitution. Language that in Article 1, Section 7, differentiates the rights of accused in proceedings on indictment and information from rights that accrue in all criminal proceedings. Although the state concludes that the language in Article 1, Section 7 clearly authorizes 6-person juries in a misdemeanor case tried on complaint, the burden is not on the state to establish the constitutionality of the act. In order to prevail, the defendant, the challenger here, bears the burden of establishing that the act is unconstitutional beyond a reasonable doubt. Flawed case law and behavioral research do not overcome the burden. The case law, particularly State versus Slow, has ignored the constitutional language. it cannot overcome that burden. The behavioral...
Just a minute. You said State versus Slow ignores the constitutional language?
There is an ellipsis in State versus Slow that skips from the first clause of Section 7 to the second clause of Section 7. This is despite the argument that was made by the state in this case that the two clauses set forth different rights for different sets of accused.
Well, then, is it your position, counsel, that Slow, Smith, and Lockwood are wrong, and so is State ex rel Sauk County DA v. Gomer? In the latter case, Gomer, it says at the top of page 410, this is a misdemeanor case, and the court's looking at the history. It's a case strongly relied on by the state, by the defense, which you, I think, only mention in one of your briefs, but let's see. Mentioned in both. In your primary brief, it's at page 19. In your supplemental brief, it's at page 9. It says in Gomer, quote, it has been held that the right to a jury trial under Section 7, Art 1, applies to misdemeanors as well as felonies, citing Slow, Smith, and Lockwood.
Smith and Lockwood were tried on information.
Are they misdemeanors?
They were misdemeanors. Slow is the only one of that trilogy that was tried on complaint. And so it was in that case that the state made the argument. The state made the argument, I believe, that misdemeanors were not crimes, and the state is not making that argument today. But the state also made the argument that the jury trial right found in Section 7 attached to trials proceedings on information and indictment and did not attach to proceedings on complaint. It was that argument that was, I don't know whether the word is exactly rejected.
What case are you talking about, Lockwood?
No, I'm talking about Slow. Slow was the only one of the Lockwood-Smith-Slow trilogy where the proceeding, all three were misdemeanors, but that's the only one where the proceeding was tried on complaint.
Well, you would have to withdraw that language from Gomer, though, if the court went your way.
You would have to withdraw the language, but there's still, as the state maintains, the case that is presently before the court, a legislatively mandated jury of 6, rather than no jury at all, or a jury where there was a kind of waiver going on. The case that is currently before the court with Act 427 has not been before the court before.
Would you also have to withdraw the language in State ex rel Sauk County? That's, I guess, the Gomer case. After that, we have the Cooley case that cites Gomer.
I'm sorry, which page are you on, please, of Gomer?
Well, Gomer, I think what the chief was talking about was 409. I don't know if that was the page chief, where the court says in Gomer, this section secures, on page 409, the bottom, this section secures to the accused in all criminal prosecutions a right of trial by jury. This section is Article 1, Section 7. The jury mentioned in said section means a jury of 12 impartial men.
There would be some language that would
as followed by State versus Cooley, which essentially says the same thing. And so we're talking, if you're going to withdraw language, you've got a number of cases you're going to have to withdraw language from that indicate, I mean, maybe some of the language maybe should be modified. I can understand that. But but the language in Gomer and the language in Cooley a few years later says, Article 1, Section 7, this section secures to the accused in all criminal prosecutions a right of trial by jury. The jury mentioned in said section means a jury of 12 impartial men, such a jury as was known to the common law and to the courts of the territory of Wisconsin, etc.
In order to rule in the state's favor, I believe this court would have to withdraw or harmonize language in its earlier decisions. The problem, however,
this
is
a Gomer's 1966, right?
Correct.
So that's literally, aren't you being kind when you say we'd have to withdraw or modify? Literally, wouldn't we have to overrule or reverse a at least four or five cases.
On the one hand, I don't think I'm being kind by saying withdraw. I don't think it's... I guess I'm, as counsel for the defendant has indicated, when I'm talking about no precedent, there is no precedent specifically on point that you would have to overrule. There is language that talks about jury, when the word jury is used in the Constitution, that means a jury of 12. That language has been applied in misdemeanor cases tried recently on complaint. On the one hand, you would have to address that language. However, if you're going to maintain that language, this court, like the slow court, would essentially have to read out the second clause, the introduction to the second clause of Section 7. It's a close case. The state does not argue that it is not, but the burden to show the unconstitutionality rests with the defendant, and we have the language of the Constitution that was drafted 150 years ago, in which the framers clearly indicated their desire to distinguish between two types of criminal prosecutions. They did so in part on the basis of cost. They were concerned with cost.
But, Ms. Rooley, when they drafted this Constitution, wasn't the assumption that there would be many, if not all, misdemeanors that would be brought by indictment? Because that's what I read your footnote to me. And that's what these early cases are, where the misdemeanor is presented in that fashion, just like a felony is. So they obviously were thinking of misdemeanors.
They weren't saying that all misdemeanors were falling under that second provision. They were saying that a certain set of offenses apparently fell under that second portion. Some of which were misdemeanors. And many of the offenses, if you look back into the Justice of the Peace treatises that were in existence at that time, many of the offenses that were then tried by Justices of the Peace on complaint are very, very much like our misdemeanors of today.
But counsel, if they went to the JP, did they have a right to trial de novo in another court with a jury? So it's sort of a test trial with before a JP. If you win, terrific. If you lose, you get a second shot. Don't we do that with municipal court now?
Right. There was, however, no intermediate court of appeal as there is today. So the structure has changed, and as you indicated, I think, in one of your last questions to defense counsel, the Constitution is intended to be a dynamic document. By the same token, in order for that dynamic document to maintain some kind of solidity, some kind of base, the language of the Constitution needs to be paid particular heed.
Let me ask you, I think you would probably concede, would you not, that stare decisis is an important principle in the law. And one of my concerns is, when you talk about the Constitution being a living document, because there's always that tension, obviously, between presidential cases and trying to adapt for modern times, I'm hard-pressed to think of a more important use of stare decisis than when a Supreme Court has spoken to what words in the Constitution mean. And what I hear you saying is, if we are to follow our precedent, the language we've used, the defense has it here, or at least it's close. You may not want to be willing to make the concession. And that we have to change our prior words on what we said that constitutional language meant in order for the state to prevail here.
Well, I think it's significant. First of all, stare decisis is not immutable. And if there is, in this long line of cases, a case that was erroneously decided, and although Slow was not directly on point because that was a total denial of a jury trial in Slow, I believe that by writing out a section of the Constitution, there's a strong argument to be made that Slough was erroneously decided, in which case stare decisis would not necessarily prevail.
I'm sorry, are you done?
Yes.
Well, tell you a couple of things that bother me. One, in your argument on Section 5, 1-5, which is the civil, seems to me you make the argument that 1-5 deals only with when there can be a jury trial, that is the subject matter of the trial, and not the form.
Right.
If that's your argument, and I don't mean to push it in that way, but that's the way I read it. If that's your argument, then it would seem to me the next argument is that in a civil case, the legislature can provide all civil cases with 6. Because your argument is the history of Section 5 indicates it was not intended to regulate the form of the jury, but only the types of issues.
It is the state's position that there is nothing in the language or in the history of the state the framing history of the state constitution that would preclude juries of 6. And this court could, as have other state courts, follow the footsteps of Williams versus Florida and hold that jury means 6 persons.
Now, okay, I think I understand that. So the state's position is that either in civil or criminal cases, the legislature could provide for 6. 6
right.
Or more, 6 to 12. Okay. The next thing that bothers me about this is that if your position is that the words present indictment, those words are very important and therefore limit the right to jury trial, then, since today we don't use indictment for misdemeanor, why isn't the defense correct to say that means that in this state the legislature could do away with jury trial in all misdemeanor cases? Now, I heard Justice Geske read a portion from your brief. I'd like to look at it again, but tell me, why doesn't it make sense to say no jury trial?
First of all, the state constitution can, in some certain circumstances, and the state is not arguing this here, but it can, in some circumstances, provide less protection than does the federal constitution.
I don't deny that at all, and that may very well be true, and I'm willing to discuss that.
It can provide less.
It just can't be effective, right?
Right.
Okay. So is that what your argument is?
No, that is not our argument. However, one answer to your question is the legislature could not do that because of the federal precedent.
Let's just talk about the state constitution, because we agreed that at least under the state, let's just talk about the state constitution for a moment.
In terms of Section 7, I think that that is a possible extension of the state's argument here. Again, we're not asking you to do that. We're just saying read, when the term jury appears in the Constitution as it does in the first clause, and if you wish to continue reading 12 into that term, the state has no objection at this point. However, then in interpreting the protection that is afforded when the proceedings are on complaint, you could approach that in either of two ways. Either read an implicit jury of 6 into that second clause, or incorporate it through the due process clause of the state constitution.
So are you, sorry, you lost me. Are you then willing to say that the constitution does not require a jury trial in misdemeanors, our state constitution, but that it's required through other techniques in our constitution, but 1-7 doesn't provide, is that what your position is?
That's not the position that the state is taking. I think it could be a logical extension of the state's position, but it is not the state's position. Also, I think that in terms of making the language a living language to apply to today, we can go back and look at the framers' concern, first of all, with the differentiation between two types of criminal proceedings, and secondly, with the costs and efficiencies that were involved. Also, since what probably or may have been intended at the time of the Constitution to fall within that second section, or justice of the peace prosecutions, those at least very closely contemporaneously with the framing of the Constitution at least went up to 6 months incarceration as a potential penalty. The kinds of offenses that were punishable then are very similar to our misdemeanors, which go up to a year today. And also the kinds of conditions that would have made a 6 month incarceration period look very similar to the framers as would a year's incarceration period now. So I think we can read what was going on then to support the notion that a different kind of jury than the 12-person common law jury can be attached to misdemeanors.
Counsel, one of the concerns and tugs that I have in this case is that it seems reasonable to me that the legislature would say, hey, given the cost and the economies, a six-person jury and misdemeanor is fine. I mean, that seems like a reasonable thing to do. But I think that one of the really awesome parts of our job as a court is that we interpret the Constitution. The Constitution is what we say the Wisconsin Constitution is. And that for five or six cases, we have said the Wisconsin Constitution gives a 12-person jury to criminal proceedings. We've said that. That's the way we have interpreted the Constitution. That means that is the Constitution. And I almost see it as a separation of powers. The legislature, sure, can change common law, but they can't, by statute, change the Constitution. And we've interpreted in our five, in Slow and Smith and Lockwood and Golmar and Cooley, to say that you're entitled to a 12-person jury. How do you get around that, other than now the court interpreting it as a living document and saying times have changed and now we interpret it differently? But other than that, how do you get around what we have said five or six times the Constitution has said? Is. Not what it said, what the Constitution is.
This is a very difficult argument to make. But if one of those cases, and the linchpin case, State versus Slow, was decided by writing out a portion, not by interpreting, but simply writing out language in the Constitution, then I think that stare decisis must give in that particular situation.
So the justices, Justice Ryan in Lockwood, and the justice who wrote the Golmar case and the Cooley case, they all missed it. They all missed that the Slow ellipsis. And although they have now proclaimed it without even citing the Slow, you know, Golmar, I don't see a cite to Slow right offhand. I certainly don't in Cooley because it cites the Golmar in the other case. We have said it. We have said this is the Constitution. And you're saying those five or six justices were wrong.
I'm saying that those cases do not coexist comfortably with the language of the Constitution. And this is a close case. And we go back then to the presumption of constitutionality, we go back to the language of the Constitution, and we go back to the fact that the burden is on the challenger in this case. There's no easy answer.
Coexist comfortably. I just conceptually have a little difference because we've interpreted what the Constitution is. We've interpreted what that language is, and that is the Constitution.
In the court, the United States Supreme Court was faced with a similar situation in the Williams case, and they had for numerous years interpreted the common law jury to be a jury of 12. They, in that case, overruled or cut back, actually didn't have to overrule, but they withdrew language in earlier cases to that effect. So it is not easy, but as the court in Bennett, or Norval, I guess, early on said, it's also a very delicate matter to declare legislation unconstitutional.
I just have one last question. One of the things that bothers me a little bit is, in your argument, the emphasis on the constitutional language about the information indictment, which historically, apparently, is how most misdemeanors came about. And the state, either through legislation or the way they charge cases, has changed that, and now it's done by complaint. So, whether it be statutorily or by procedure, the state can change the procedure and then say you're not entitled to what you used to be able to have, a constitutional right to a jury trial, and now you don't anymore. How does that fit into this, or doesn't it?
Not comfortably, Your Honor.
Okay. Good. Then I asked the right question.
I think the response to that is there are other provisions in the Constitution, the Due Process Clause, for example, that could be invoked at that point to prevent the legislature or to hold such legislation unconstitutional.
So what you're telling me is that there's another attack on this statute, which is not here, I understand. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm saying, I understood your question to be, well, what's to keep the legislature from saying that first-degree homicide will be charged by
complaint? Well, I mean, apparently, I didn't follow this through, whether it's by practice or by statute, that all misdemeanors, I think it's statute, that misdemeanors are started by complaints. And by statute, the legislature has been able to then say, all those people that were protected under Section 7 before are no longer protected because we're simply changing the method by which the criminal proceeding starts.
I guess I fall back again on either how you would interpret that second clause.
So it's the state's option, right, as to how they want to proceed?
In felony cases, currently by statute, we proceed on information.
In your argument, the next thing is the legislature said, well, we want to have six-person juries in first-degree intentional homicide cases, so you can start with that with a criminal complaint. Then your argument is, well, maybe there's some due process or something else
that
may be
involved. Right. That would be one break on it. It's hard until that case presents itself. And the language of that specific legislation.
You don't see that a problem with misdemeanors?
No.
And why not? If misdemeanors historically were started with information in indictments and no longer are, and that's done by virtue of statute, and if I'm making wrong assumptions, let me know. By statute, the legislature's been able to take out Section 7th right of those class of people by virtue of a statute.
They've done it, I think, more through the court reorganization and what courts hear what cases. What I think that the legislature has done pretty consistently is keep the same class of cases or the same proportional penalty classification of cases as triable with the 12-person under the judicial interpretation, the 12-person jury, as opposed to the misdemeanors, which we're now saying fall under.
But historically, when the early cases were decided, misdemeanors, under your argument, were covered and would have had a right to a 12-person jury, and they no longer do.
Some misdemeanors, not all misdemeanors.
Right. Okay.
But we're moving on to another subject. This morning, before I was so rudely interrupted. That's an inside joke. I had a question regarding this common law right.
Yes, Your Honor.
Does the state concede that there is a common law right to a name change in the state?
The state concedes that there is a common law right to a name change. The state does not concede that there is a defense of common law name change, particularly to the obstruction.
Could you explain that? What do you mean there's not a defense? I don't understand.
We concede that there is a common law name, a right to a common law name change in Wisconsin.
Right.
But we are not conceding that common law name change is a legitimate defense to the charge of obstructing, particularly not on these facts where the defendant wasn't asked, are you, or what is your name, but was asked, are you Ronald Hansford? that in that common law name change process, identity doesn't change, and so that he obstructed, basically, when he said, no, I'm not Ronald Hansford.
So if I'm asked, are you, somebody, the police officer says to me, what's your name? And I say, Shirley Abrahamson. And then the officer says to me, are you Shirley Schlanger? Which is my birth name. I say, no, that is an obstruction of justice. I mean, I'm assuming that there's something else in there. They want to know if I'm Shirley Schlanger because they think I did something else. I mean, it's a...
I think
the same fact is here, but I'm asked about a birth name.
It's...
And 45 years ago, I was known by that name.
In that case, I think there would be a more legitimate... support for giving the instruction, because the length of time would be the difference in that case. In this case, we have a much shorter time frame, and we also...
Wasn't there an argument that he'd used the name for 9 years?
I'm sorry?
Wasn't there an argument, or at least some evidence, I know it was disputed, some evidence that he'd used the other name for 9 years?
He'd used the other name for 9 years, but he had also been, at the same time, using... unlike the example that Justice Abrahamson gave, had been using the name Ronald Hansford on legal documents.
Well, but periodically I'm asked and I respond with my birth name. My high school records are in my birth name. My college records are in my birth name. People who knew me more years than we care to talk about know me by my birth name. I use my birth name to identify my checking accounts and other accounts, you know, thinking no one else knows my birth name. Now everybody knows my birth name. what I'm trying to get at is it the fact that when asked his former name, that there was a crime connection with that former name, that what makes an obstruction of justice? Or is it the very concept that, as you stated, identity? I mean, clearly, Shirley Abrahamson is identical to Shirley Schlanger. I mean, we're one and the same person. I know that when I respond. So why would you distinguish between me and Mr. Hansford? I see you got
in this
name, Hansford. Okay, go ahead.
In this case, there was a denial of identity.
Right.
And I think also in this case there were enough other factors, and now we're kind of off on the instruction onto the general evidence, which is not the issue before the court. But it was the denial of identity. If he had been asked, is your name Ronald Hansford, and he had said yes, or if he had been asked, is your name Brian Storm? Is your name Brian Storm? And he had said yes. I think there would have been he would have been more entitled to an instruction. I think in this case, though, there are two other more important points that support the denial of the instruction. First of all, the instruction that was proposed did not completely accurately state the law of common law name change. It didn't include that it can't be used for a fraudulent purpose. And under State versus Holt, this court can affirm for a reason other than the trial court affirmed. And also there was uncontroverted evidence that coexistent with using the name Brian Storm, he was using the name Ronald Hansford.
In other words, you're suggesting you can make a choice, but you can't go with both of them at the same time.
When you're asked about your identity, and one of those two options you've been using, you can't.
What's the standard of review on the denial for the theory of defense instruction?
It's abuse of discretion in this particular case. The argument is that the judge erroneously exercised his discretion because he overlooked...
Are there constitutional implications? to denying a theory of defense instruction?
There can be, but I don't think they're present in this particular case. I noticed
Ms. Rulli, don't you also make an argument that in this particular case there were other instructions which covered the defense?
That is correct, Your Honor.
What are those instructions?
The instruction on knowingly provided the misinformation, and that the argument that defense counsel then addressed himself to in closing argument was that Brian Storm, Ronald Hansford, believed he was Brian Storm, and that was his name, and was not knowingly misleading the officers. I notice my red light is on.
Thank you, Ms. Rulli. After.
I'd just like to go back to a moment for something that Justice Geske had raised, and a concern about the legislature's ability to eliminate a jury trial right by changing the charging document. And I don't think that concern is at all far-fetched. There has been a proposal in the Committee of the Judicial Council to eliminate the preliminary hearings in felonies. And if that happened, and then felonies were charged just by complaint, I think the logical conclusion under the state's argument is that there would be no right to a jury trial under the state constitution, even in felony cases. So I think this court, over the years, has wisely stayed away from hinging the right to a jury trial on the label that was assigned to the particular charging document. And the law is clear that misdemeanors do come within the jury trial right of Section 7. There has been a lot of discussion by the state about our burden of proof. We recognize that burden. We believe we have met it beyond a reasonable doubt through stare decisis, that principle which also requires the court to act with extreme caution when it is being called upon to overrule or withdraw language from other decisions. And I would submit that the court would have to overrule a half a dozen criminal cases, two court of appeals decisions, if it were to find Act 427 constitutional. There was also a reference, I believe, by Justice Bradley to the Williams decision and keeping our document in touch with the times and vital. And I think it's important to recognize that the decisions of this court interpreting the state constitution, concluding that it guarantees a right to a jury of 12, is not dependent upon the federal constitution or the federal case law. The Norville decision, the Bennett, those that have come after, were not turning their attention to what the federal constitution provided. They were really looking at what the common law provided in Wisconsin at the time the constitution was adopted.
Also, I know we don't have much time, but I wanted to talk about this name change just for a moment. Assuming, and there's no question the state is conceding that there is a common law right to change the name, their position, as I understand it, is that it has to be a consistent use, not one where you're using Ronald Hansford, for example, and then Brian Storm another time, or John Jones another time. Do you take issue with that?
That's
basically, otherwise I'd ask how many name changes or how many names can you have? Can you have a dozen names and let's say you use one for 2 years and then you switch and use another for 2 years, but you, at the time of the infraction, you can say, no, my name is so-and-so for this time.
No, I agree that under the common law, to perfect a name change, there you have to adopt the name and you have to use it continuously. But there was evidence in this case to show that that was what the defendant had done. Now, there was some conflicting evidence, but there certainly was sufficient evidence to raise a jury question.